Hello and welcome to episode 412 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson. With me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. You can be LSAT famous, share news, and ask questions on our website. That's thinkinglsat.com. This Wednesday, August 9th at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, we're going to have a pre-test pump-up with Chris.
Should be
pre-test
fun.
Pump-up.
Uh-huh.
Where did we come up with that name?
boy, I wish I could give appropriate credit for whoever came up with that. But yeah, one of our team members, it might have been Lily, actually, who is now departing for law school. I think Lily came up with the pre-test pump-up, and now Chris has taken over that idea. It's just the, you know, everybody who's taken the August test, get together, get some last-minute advice, and probably, you know, cultural references from Chris. And should be fun.
That guy's a jokester. So yeah, go just for the laughs with Chris.
Yeah, really.
You can sign up for that at lsat.link/free. You can also just find all our free classes by going to lsatdemon.com/classes and checking out what's there. Wow, tomorrow, July 25th, is the September 2023 registration deadline. There's going to be a Demon Daily podcast. That's episode 572, where we talk about how to know if you're ready to register for that test. So go ahead and check that out. You can find all the dates at lsat.link/dates. Let's jump in. We have a comment here on YouTube from a Demon Basic student.
Says, the meditation in the middle of drilling is a brilliant addition to the program. We all need to remember to take a deep breath. I was working on logical reasoning and literally read the question again after closing my eyes for a few seconds and was like, really? This is fucking easy. While 1 minute ago, I was considering driving off a bridge because my brain could not figure it out. That's nice. Yeah, the meditation thing was something that we kind of added to the demon without really much thought. And it has turned out to be a really pretty impactful little part of the demon. By the way, if you don't want to meditate, you just hit skip and go right on to your drilling. But we've had so many students tell us that that little meditation that pops up every once in a while, just reminding them, that's what is it, every 45 minutes or something pops up and says, hey, you know, maybe take a 3-5 minute break. And yeah, we're really happy that that has been so well received.
Yeah, that has been something. Some people have even cried, right? So, okay.
Yeah, it's one of the only times. I've made people cry sometimes in class, but other than me making people cry in class, the meditation has made people cry in a different way where, yeah, they were like amazed that we gave a shit about their mental health. We do, because it helps you with your scores. So, yeah, anyway, that's a nice note.
Okay. This next question is apparently about diagramming in logical reasoning. I'll go ahead and read it. I'm on month two with the LSAT demon, and I've noticed that I've had a hard time diagramming some sentences in my head, and it helps me comprehend the ideas more when I diagram them on a sheet of paper. Semicolon. Why do you guys discourage demon users from diagramming LR sentences on paper? How do I improve my comprehension of following the logic of logical reasoning passages when it is convoluted? I noticed that for some questions you guys have diagrammed and others you don't. Why is that the case? Well, let's work backward here. Some of those videos are from a long time ago. So, but I think most of them have been removed by now.
Oh, if you see, let's be clear. If you see logical reasoning videos in the demon where we're doing a lot of diagramming on the whiteboard, you can go ahead and flag that, hit the ask button, downvote that explanation. Tell us that that's happening, because that's old school dogmatic shit that we used to do 10 years ago, 15 years ago when we were baby LSAT teachers. And we have learned over time that diagramming, you know, it always takes time. It's very costly time wise, which we don't care about that much, except for it also paradoxically causes people to make the very errors that they are allegedly trying to avoid by making the diagram. So things like confusing sufficient for necessary, I just can't tell you. We used to teach this diagramming way back. We used to teach this diagramming as a way of like, oh no, you need to get in there and diagram this formal logic so that you can really understand it. And then I just see like dozens after dozens after dozens of students who are trying, you know, earnestly to do the diagramming, and then they end up fucking it up on the paper, and then they end up confusing sufficient for necessary or making some other logical error. It creates more of a problem than it ever solves, and it always costs time. So we've gone completely away from diagramming at all on logical reasoning. This writer, by the way, and this is what Anonymous. Anonymous is fairly astute here for noticing that I have a hard time diagramming some sentences. And it's like, well, yeah, because some sentences can't even be diagrammed. So what do you like? Why are we trying to diagram everything?
Well, this person says I've had a hard time diagramming some sentences in my head. And I think the challenge here is that this person is still diagramming. They're just doing it mentally as opposed to on paper, right? And what we're saying is, no, you're actually thinking about this differently. You're comprehending what the conditional statement is saying.
Yeah.
On an intuitive level, which is a different way of thinking. It's not, oh, okay, I read the sentence and now I'm going to visualize in my head an arrow going from A to B or from B to C or whatever, right? It's like, no, you're going to read that sentence. You're going to understand what it really means. If it says, if you go to the store, then you're going to buy cheese, you're going to think in your head, you're like, wow, okay. So no matter what, when I show up at that grocery store, I have to buy cheese. Doesn't matter if the grocery store is on fire. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And if you can understand that and feel what that means, right? Feel that,
yeah.
Oh, every time I show up at the grocery store, cheese is going to be bought by me.
Yeah.
Well, then you're in a much better position to deal with the other sentences that may or may not relate to that. And it's different from just thinking in your head, oh, if S, then C. Oh, I got that in my head. I didn't write it down, so I'm doing what Ben and Nathan have told me. I'm not diagramming. No, you're still diagramming. You're just not doing it on paper.
Yeah. You need to understand these premises. And you also need to recognize that only like not even half of the sentences on LR are going to be conditional. So, you know, the second they say some or most, then that kind of formal logic diagramming breaks down. And the second they start talking about cause and effect, or the second they do anything other than offer you clear conditional premises, there's no point to doing that diagramming. So it's more trouble than it's worth. It will cause you to miss just as many questions or more questions as it's helping you to solve. It is very time consuming. For the people who can do that kind of diagramming correctly, you know, I could make a pretty picture on the board and I could show you, you know, formally, I could show you a solution to some of the questions on logical reasoning. But the people who are capable of doing that correctly on the board or on the page are also capable of just understanding it intuitively and working it through in your head, except faster. It's just, it's the type of thing where it's like you could show off as a, you know, like go into fancy LSAT teacher mode to show off this diagramming. But in the moment when you're actually just trying to solve a question, it just doesn't actually help students solve questions. So that's why we don't teach it anymore.
One thing that I think you're kind of getting to, but I haven't heard it maybe explicitly, or I just want to make sure people understand this. The biggest problem I have with diagramming is, when you take a sentence and you translate it from, if I go to the store, then I'm going to buy cheese. So if S, then C, that S and C, those two letters become symbols for everything that that sentence is saying, right? And that works in a very simple sentence. If I say, if I go to the store, then I'm going to buy cheese. There's really not a lot of nuance there. And so maybe replacing those ideas with letters such as C and S can work. The problem is that a lot of sentences are much more nuanced than that. And people, when, as soon as they start diagramming, right, they go to the letter. That letter now symbolizes much more than just going to the store. And the right or wrong answer can play off of a change in that nuance, and you're totally unaware of it. And so I think that's a bit, and it's funny too, when people start diagramming and then they use one letter and they use S, and then they get confused and later think the S was not referring to store, but was referring to sandwich, because that came up somewhere later in that's one kind of confusion. But the other real confusion here is you're still talking about store, but they had specific things that they said about going to the store, like going to the store on Wednesday when it's cloudy outside. They don't capture that all in their variable.
Yeah.
And then they forget. They forget those details, and that makes a difference. So
another,
it's just an,
I agree. And another type of error that can happen, I think. So we have a question here. This is from Test J. So we can talk about it freely. Test J, section 2, question 6. Here's the argument, okay? And let's think through what we might do if we were diagramming. And I think we could see that it might actually cause you to sort of miss the trick in the question. An undergraduate degree is necessary for appointment to the executive board. So you start diagramming, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you're going to be on the executive board, then you have to have an undergraduate degree.
Yep.
Further, no one with a felony conviction can be appointed to the board. Okay, so if you're on the board, then you can't have a felony conviction. Or maybe you also diagram the contrapositive, which, you know, that's
and then you get like, you already have four statements at this point, right? You have four diagrams.
Right, and I want to point out that, like, we don't even say the word contrapositive anymore. You know, like, oh, you think that whole thing is really wildly confusing and you think the LSAT sucks because you hate thinking about the contrapositive? Well, guess what? If you do it our way, you don't have to think about the contrapositive anymore. You just have to understand what these rules are saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, what the rules have said so far is that a felony conviction or lack of an undergraduate degree will disqualify you from the board.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to be writing down a bunch of hieroglyphics in order to understand that. And if you do start writing down a whole bunch of hieroglyphics on your paper, then now all of a sudden you've got this additional bewildering thing on your paper. Right. I mean, I'm envisioning two conditional statements linked together and then the mirror of that in the contrapositive. It's like, wow, that's a lot of work for just understanding that if you want to be on the board, you can't have a felony. And also, if you want to be on the board, you have to have an undergraduate degree. That's not that complicated. But you're going to be overcomplicating it by putting all this shit on the page. Right. And we haven't even gotten to the crux of the question yet.
Yeah.
So it goes on and it says, thus, Murray, an accountant with both a bachelor's and a master's degree, cannot be accepted for the position of executive administrator since he has a felony conviction. Good luck trying to add that into your diagram, by the way. I mean, that's part of that's a premise, part of that's a conclusion. So part of it you need to add to like the rules of the game. And then part of that you need to say you need to be skeptical of. If you're doing it right, you just need to be skeptical, right? But people are going to be like faithfully copying all this down. If then. I have a feeling they get down to the end of this and in their diagram, they go, yeah, perfect. Perfect. Yeah. Murray can't be on the, no.
Yeah. He has a felony conviction. Yeah. And so that means he can't be appointed to the board. So, okay. Yeah. Executive administrator out. Yeah. Right. It's like it distracts you, right? It's like it's
absolutely
smoke and mirrors from what's really going on here. Right. It's like, what does executive administrator have anything to do with being appointed to the board?
Well,
we don't know.
That's the trick of the question, right? Is that, oh, the executive administrator, of course, that's a board position. I mean, it's the executive, you know, he's accepted for a position of the executive administrator, but he has a felony. He clearly can't be because, I don't know. The trick of the question is you just have to ask the question, hey, is the executive administrator a board position?
Yeah.
But I don't think your diagram helps you ask that question. In fact, I am pretty sure that your diagram impedes you from getting to that question. And that's why we don't teach diagramming, because we do logical reasoning in a much easier way. I mean, our students make huge fundamental improvements in logical reasoning, and it does not come from diagramming. It comes from getting in there and actually understanding what they're trying to say and from figuring out a way to call bullshit. But I just don't think that diagram helps you call bullshit.
Yeah,
I'm sure it doesn't. I'm sure it hurts most people. And I learned that the hard way. I came up as a PowerScore teacher in 2007, million years ago. And I taught the way they taught me, which was heavy-handed diagramming of all these questions. Yeah. And it's painful. It's boring. It's difficult. And it's confusing. And over the years, I realized, boy, it's a hell of a lot easier to attack logical reasoning if you just expect them to lie to you and then read it carefully, read it really critically. And I don't need a diagram to go, wait a second, board is not the same thing as executive administrator, not necessarily. But yeah, that diagram is not going to help me make that objection.
So one thing about this process that I do want to warn people about, and I do see this in class, is that people get used to this diagramming method, right? And then they come to class and it's like, let go. And they're kind of half letting go, kind of like this listener was writing about, right? So they're kind of still diagramming in their head, which means they're using a different part of your brain. It's a different part of your brain. It's the same thing, I think, that I got the sense when I was reading that book, Thinking Fast and Slow.
Okay.
When we do the intuitive approach, yeah, you're slowing down to understand the sentence. But what you're doing is you're powering up the fast part of your brain. You're powering up, you're giving your intuition the tools it needs to engage with the content. But when you do diagramming, you're using a totally different mental process. You're using math. Let's sit here and write down formulas. I don't understand intuitively why this is true, but when I do all the formulas and they work together, then this is the outcome, right? It's a totally different way of thinking. And so one, when you start doing what we're talking about, you have to fully let go of diagramming. You have to fully embrace, no, I'm just going to try to intuitively understand what this sentence is saying and trust in the process. And at first, I think that for people, it can be challenging. It's easier in the end, but I think people have to like get comfortable really trying to understand the sentence. And then once they do that, it's going to click and it's going to be a lot easier. But there is going to be this like wall, probably because of what they've learned before, that's preventing them from really experiencing what it's like to intuitively understand what they're reading.
It's easier if you don't diagram. I think, you know, let's continue this question, Ben. We've already attacked this argument from Test J. You know, it's like our objection is clear. Is the executive administrator a board position?
Yeah.
Because if it is, then the argument's perfect. But if it's not, then the argument is far from perfect.
Yeah.
Here's the question. The argument's conclusion follows logically if which one of the following is assumed. And you're like, yeah, you see that and you go, aha. Like, it's so fun to do it our way, right?
Yeah.
So talk me through, like, why did you smile there?
Okay. Well, first of all, I recognize this is a sufficient assumption question, which means, as it literally says, it's asking for an answer choice that if it were true or assumed, would make the conclusion true. And I already know the answer to that because right now the big question on my mind is the position of executive administrator a position on the executive board? If it is, then this argument makes sense.
Yeah, then the conclusion follows logically, yeah. Right? One thing that we do as well that I kind of want to think about this a little bit. You know, we immediately hop to sufficient assumption, right? Mm-hmm, well, this question doesn't say the word sufficient anywhere in it. We're recognizing that that's a common sufficient assumption question stem. And we have techniques for sufficient assumption, which basically is you got to predict the answer. You got to make the argument win. But as Ben pointed out, the words on the page say exactly that. Okay. They just say it in different words. The words say the argument's conclusion follows logically if which one of the following is assumed. So you could rearrange that. One of the following will make the conclusion follow logically. And follow logically means you got to prove it. That's what, yeah. If it follows logically, that means it's like, well, hey, if the premises are true, then this conclusion is also true. It follows logically.
Yeah.
Right? So yep. Which one will make the conclusion follow logically? And we both go, well, it's pretty good, except for the part where they never said that the executive administrator is a board position.
Yep.
And so if we added that to the evidence, if we know, and right, if this was your client, you know, if your client seems sensible and they're telling you all this, mm-hmm. you would go, wait, hold on a second. So you're telling me that the executive administrator is a board position. Is that right? Okay, cool. Well, yeah. Good. Because if we put that into our argument, then our conclusion follows logically.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so we've already predicted the answer. Now we go into the answer choices. I want you to like hit stop on me, okay? Like just tell me to stop when you're not going to read the answer any further. Because what's your prediction?
My prediction is the executive administrator is a position on the executive board. That's great. All I need to know. And I don't know how they're going to word it. And it doesn't, I don't need it to be worded that exact way. I just need the answer to convey that idea. And then I'm good.
Right. Okay, so tell me when you're going to stop me, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A, anyone with a master's degree, he's like, huh?
It seems like it's going in the wrong direction, but I also don't have a problem with it per se because this guy has a master's degree. So I'm like, okay.
If you want to anyone with a master's degree and without a felony conviction.
Nope, stop.
Okay, perfect. You're stopping me because this guy does have a felony conviction.
Yeah. Not we're not talking that, about these people. Yeah.
Like the answer has to say the executive administrator is a position on the board, or it has to say something that means exactly that.
Now, I didn't stop you after master's degree because this answer choice is a little bit long, right? And maybe it would go on and say that. And I'd be like, okay, I don't know why you threw in the master's degree bit, but that's okay because this guy has a master's degree. But yeah, anyways, without a felony conviction kills it.
Yeah. Okay. B, only candidates eligible for appointment to the executive board can be accepted for the position of executive administrator.
Okay. So that's interesting. That's basically saying if you want to be the executive administrator, then you have to be eligible for appointment to the executive board, which Murray is not.
Yeah. Murray has a felony. Murray's not eligible for the board. B doesn't say exactly what we wanted it to say, but it has the same effect. You read that and you go, you think it through and you go, well, wait a second. I do know that Murray can't be on the board. And B says, if you can't be on the board, then you can't be executive administrator. Okay, so maybe executive administrator doesn't matter whether it is or is not on the board. If B's true, then anybody who's ineligible for the board is ineligible for the position of executive administrator. Okay, so that one does it in kind of a weird way.
Yep.
All right. C, an undergraduate degree is not necessary for acceptance for the position of executive administrator.
Okay. One less requirement, not helpful.
I wouldn't have read further than an undergraduate degree is not necessary. I mean, at least on the first pass through.
Yeah.
And especially once I've already identified B as like, yeah, that's going to do it. Then when I read the rest of these answers, man, I'm going to be like real quick to dismiss them. That's the only time I ever go fast on the LSAT is that on wrong answers, which I say this on just about every show, but it's so important that I have to keep saying it. Wrong answers are wrong. They're 80% of the time, whatever answer you're reading is wrong.
Yep.
So we expect them to be wrong, and we're not I'm not even conclusively eliminating answers. I'm quick to pass. It's like, probably not. When I start reading an answer, probably not. And then the second it starts meandering off into an undergraduate degree being not necessary, it's like, huh? This guy has a master's and a felony. It also does have a bachelor's degree. So saying a bachelor's is not necessary is like, that's just doing nothing. But point is, you know, to be efficient here, you got to start attacking the arguments, you got to predict the answers, and then you got to be ruthless on the answer choices. D, if Murray did not have a felony conviction.
Stop.
Yeah. Wait, he does. So who cares what would happen if he didn't?
Yeah, it's a hypothetical we don't care about. Yep.
E, the felony charge on which Murray was convicted is relevant to the duties of the position of executive administrator.
I don't care because I don't know whether that relevance matters for his appointment.
Right. The rule didn't say if you have a felony and it's the type of felony that's relevant to your job. Like, where did relevance to your job ever come? Huh? That's not what we're doing here, right? We're doing LSAT logical reasoning is a lot like computer programming where, yeah. I mean, the inputs and that it has to match up exactly.
Yep.
Or it has to be synonyms at least, right? But relevant to the duties, that's just shit that was not in this argument at all. We don't know what the duties are. We don't care what's relevant to those duties. Can Murray be executive administrator? Well, I don't know. Is that position on the board or does it have similar qualifying criteria as the board? And that's what B does. And that's why that's the answer.
So I just checked the correct answer. We did get it right. It is B. I also notice because in the daemon, we indicate how tempting the other wrong answers are, right? And the most tempting wrong answer here is answer choice D, which is the one that starts with if Murray did not have a felony conviction.
And I'm not ever reading that any further than that if clause. If it goes, if Murray did not have, I go, I don't care. I'm trying to disqualify Murray from who does have a felony from the executive board. You talking about what Murray does or does not, you know, if he didn't have a felony.
Yeah.
I just don't care.
I mean, this is very different. If it said if Murray did have a felony conviction, something like that, I would still be interested because he does. Right. So it's like, yeah, and he does. So what do you want to tell me about those kind of people? But he does. And this is saying if he didn't. So we didn't even read this entire answer choice yet. Right. This was the most tempting wrong answer. In other words, a lot of people read it, liked it. They read it in its entirety and they went on to choose it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot you can learn once you become like a real master of this test. You just have to get to a point where you really understand what it's saying and what matters and what doesn't.
Look, it's true. I actually don't read all the words on every question. I think people would be shocked to find that out.
Let's clarify that you're talking about answers.
On the answer choices. Yeah. No, yeah. I literally do a shorter test than everyone else because I'm just not going to have patience for bullshit wrong answers.
But you're also going to have that lack of patience for logical reasons, right? Like, it's not like you're just impatient.
Yeah. No, I'm not just skimming them.
Oh, I'm done with that one. It's like,
no.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, no, there's a reason for leaving D in the dust.
I was going back and forth with one of our tutors, Ala, on our teacher Slack about, she was talking about a student who does a vibe check. And I love doing a vibe check on the answer choices where it's like, but the thing is, I have real high standards for what the vibes need to be. Mm-hmm. And that answer needs to be speaking to me because if it's not like telling me what I want to hear, then I'm just going to be passing on that answer without even reading the entire thing. And I'm going to do that on half the answer choices, probably. Like if there's five answers on a particular question, I would say I'm going to read every word of the right answer. I mean, the one that I end up picking, I will read every single word of and really understand it.
Yeah.
But the wrong answers that I'm not going to pick, I just have to decide that I'm not going to pick them. And on a first pass through, I very frequently am only reading half of the answer and deciding, nah, probably not. I'm not conclusively eliminating it, but I'm also not like leaving it open. And so contrast the two different approaches, because what the student was doing was reading every word of an answer and then giving it like a, yeah, okay, maybe, and then reading the next answer And doing a vibe check where the student is vibing with like three different answers. that's never happening for me. I will frequently eliminate all five on a first pass through, and then I'll have to lower my standards a little bit and kind of reread some of them. That happens on one out of every 10, one out of every 8 questions, maybe, where I get through all five of them without really seeing anything that feels right. But I never, ever am going to read an answer, think it's okay, you know, like not think it through deep enough to really like it. I'm not going to vouch for it. I'm not going to pick it, but I'm like read all of it and go, yeah, that's a contender. And then move on to the next one and find another contender. Well, there's no two contenders. There's one right answer and the other one's wrong. So if you're going to keep answers around, you have to be willing to vouch for the whole thing. And it's far more frequent if an expert's doing it, it's far more frequent that the expert's just going to scan the first half of the answer and go, nah, probably not. Let's read the next one. And that's how you end up going fast. I read the arguments much slower. I read the question much slower than a typical student. I take time to predict my answers, but then I'm armed. I know what I'm looking for. I have a really good handle on the argument. I know what they're asking me. And then the answers just start to look like shit. Read, if Murray did not have a felony conviction, and I'm like, goodbye. And as Ben pointed out, that was the most commonly chosen wrong answer. So it's a dramatically different way of approaching the test, isn't it?
It is. And you can get there.
Yeah. Yeah. You can get there with practice, but that's one of the biggest errors, I think, is that students are not critical enough of wrong answer choices when every answer has an 80% chance of being wrong. And they read answer choices hoping that they're right. That's not a good way to do it. Because if you hope that they're right, then you're going to find a little, you know, you're going to find these little phrases that you like and you're going to latch on to those. And then next thing you know, you've got two or three competing answers that there's parts that you like. But instead, you should be looking to dismiss answers because there's shit in there that you don't like, or it just here on a sufficient assumption question, it just doesn't, it's just not even attempting to answer the question. Okay. Do we need to wrap it up on the diagramming?
Yeah. So this is the takeaway that I hope that everyone got from this. One, don't diagram in logical reasoning. Instead, focus 100% on trying to intuitively get and understand the sentences that you're reading one at a time. That's your goal. The goal is so important because even if you're not there today, you're heading in the right direction. If your goal is to diagram, then you're slowly going to get better at diagramming. It's a dead end road, right? Like it's not the best approach. And so if you have the wrong goal, then you're going to be practicing the wrong things and setting yourself up for failure.
I don't think it's going to even help you at all. But if it does help you, it's going to help you go from like 13 questions correct to like 15 questions correct. It's going to be arduous. It's going to take forever. It's not going to be fun. It's going to make the LSAT seem like work. And best case, you might improve by one or two questions, I think, in a section of logical reasoning.
Well, and this tactic is very specific for only a subset of a subset of questions. Right. Whereas the intuitive approach, as you get better
works on every question.
Yeah. You're going to get better at the diagramming-esque questions and all the others at the same time.
I think that the diagramming is right. It's going to help you on maybe two questions on the section. And then on all the other questions, it's going to probably hurt you. So, you know, I'm being very generous and saying, okay, if you learn this technique and you only deploy it on the two questions on the section where it might help you, which, by the way, how did you get that good? Man, that's like you know which ones it's going to help you on. Okay.
I'm sure some people listening right now are like, oh, well, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to use this intuitive technique for all the others. Then I'm going to use diagramming for these two. But I tell you, even then, only one of those two really works well, if at all, with diagramming. The other one is going to send you down a rabbit hole.
Yeah. Well, there's so many questions where the first sentence seems like you should diagram it, and the second sentence seems like you should diagram it. And then the third and fourth sentences have nothing to do with conditionality and don't really relate to those previous sentences anyway. And it's like, turns out to be that the crux of the question has nothing to do with diagramming a whole thing.
Yeah. And the sentences aren't as hard as they sound when you actually just like, you're like, oh, all it's saying is that everybody who eats, frosted mini wheats,
you're making it harder by diagramming it. But again, being generous, let's say that it does help you on those two questions. The best case, you know, you're going from 13 to 15. On the other hand, if you would really adopt our intuitive approach to attacking these arguments and really understanding it, the logical reasoning is going to start to seem fun. And you're going to go, you know, instead of going from 13 to 15, you're going to go from 13 to 19 or 13 to 22. And it's like, that's what does it for us. Okay. And that's why we are able to get people 20 point, 25 point improvements, sometimes 30 point improvements on the LSAT. It does not come from bullshit technicalities. It comes from like really mastering and realizing how easy the LSAT is. And it's the only thing I care about. I'm not interested in getting our students incremental progress. I want to transform the way our students think about the LSAT.
Yeah. Well, talking about point improvement, did you see on Slack I can't remember which teacher posted it, but some student had made a 37 point progress so far. That's just on practice tests. But I was like, wow, that's knocking on the door of a 40 point improvement. I mean, that's insane. We'll have to see what happens on the official test.
That would be our first one ever, a 40 point improvement. But yeah, this was somebody sending us screenshots of the demon score history. And they had It was a 130 something practice test and then a 170 something practice test.
I think it was 137 or 8 or something like that. And then 173, 74. Yeah, somewhere around there.
Yeah. Well, that does not come from diagramming logical reasoning. You know, I mean, that comes from like really transforming the way that you're thinking about the test and making a game of it. Right. Like we are teaching you the fun way that also leads to you just hitting home runs. So if you're interested in that, then do it our way. If you're interested in, I want it to be arduous and I want just marginal improvement. Okay. Then you can do it other ways.
Yep.
All right. Next one.
Yeah. This one's from Anonymous. The subject is, am I tired or stupid?
Whoa.
?
Hey y'all. So because of work, I have broken up my studying into two chunks a day. I usually drill 30 minutes to an hour in the morning. And then later in the evening, I review any mistakes I had. I hate it already. Through the review inbox feature. I hate it.
Yeah, there's a disconnect between, it's like drilling and trying to get questions done and then reviewing hours later. I'd rather you do one question and review it, do another question and review it, and then call it a morning.
You're doing it wrong. Yeah. I mean, I'll continue with the question here. I try to ask myself, however, when I try the question again, I sometimes get it correct. I try to ask myself why I picked the wrong answer, but during my evening review, I can't understand what morning me was thinking. My initial reaction was that it just might be mental fatigue, since I can drill several questions, but only have to review a handful. But I'm not sure if that's the right way to think about it. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what's going on between the morning and the afternoon. Thanks, y'all. Well, the answer to the question is you need to review your mistakes immediately. That's the whole point of drilling. Stop doing long sections of drilling and just allowing yourself to miss questions and then move on to a new question. You need to review it right then in the moment.
Nathan. Do we have an epidemic of people touching and getting burned by hot stoves?
I don't think we do, because when you get burned by a hot stove, you immediately learn from it. You feel the pain immediately and you go, I don't want to do that anymore.
Yeah, but we have a lot of other epidemics because the consequence of the behavior is extraordinarily delayed, sometimes by decades, right? And so people don't learn. The same is true here. You got to do a question and then you got to, ideally, right, with drilling, if you're not sure about the answer you're choosing, keep working on it. I mean, at some point you got to hit submit and then go to the explanation and figure it out. But I look at drilling as an opportunity to really push yourself to be the one to find the answer. Figure it out. It might take you 20 minutes, but if you do that yourself, you've lifted the weight. We haven't done that for you, right? And then you can confirm with the explanation. People feel like that's ineffective or slow, or, oh, geez, dear God, I only did two questions this morning before work. But it's like, yeah, but you did them yourself.
Yeah, you actually solved it. I mean, I think what's going on here, Anonymous, is that like when you get it right during your evening review, that's because you're actually doing that question during your evening review. When you're drilling, you're doing some weird mindless, like you're not really doing it. You're not really digging in. You're just kind of like, well, I want to make sure that I drill at least 25 questions during my morning drilling section, and I'll get to the review later. And you're not really caring whether you get it right or wrong. Well, you need to care, and you need to just start getting them right.
Yep.
The way I do LR in class now, I share my screen on a question and I have people send me direct messages telling me what the answer is. One of the things, I mean, it's like consistently in not every class, but pretty close to every class, the answers will come in like, you know, because they're just coming in the background, right? Nobody knows when anybody else is answering the question, but the answers will come in like B, D, C, 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 C.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What's going on there? Well, the people who answered B and D right off the bat, immediately before anybody else had even answered the question, you're not doing it. You're not solving the question. Those people who are answering 3 minutes from now instead of 1 minute from now are actually doing the question. They're actually solving it and they're really figuring it out. I don't think for Anonymous here, I don't think it has anything to do with mental fatigue. I think it has everything to do with just, you're not really trying to get those questions right. And you need to try to get those questions right.
Yeah.
Slower is better. Safety first. I'm not impressed by how quickly you answer incorrectly. I'm quite the opposite of impressed by that. Right. And I'm not impressed by how quickly you answer correctly either. I'm impressed by, did you answer correctly? That's the only thing I care about. If you can figure it out, then you understand the LSAT. And if you understand the LSAT, then you're going to do great, regardless of speed. But, you know, people just, they just resist that. And they just think, nope, I got to do a certain amount of work. I got to do it in a certain amount of time. I got to hurry up and send in the answer. Or in their drilling, got to hurry up and just click an answer and move on to the next one. And then not even worry about it that you just missed that question. I mean, the demon's telling this student that they're wrong, right?
Yeah.
Flashing red at them and telling them, nope. And offering them, would you like to watch our video explanations? Would you like to read our written explanations? Would you like to use the ask button to make sure that you can clarify why you got that one wrong, that you just got wrong? And so separating that review inbox is great for reviewing your practice tests, reviewing your timed sections, maybe reviewing questions that you missed in class, but you shouldn't be filling up your review inbox with your drilling results. Drilling should be clean, right? Like you should get done with a session of drilling, and that includes doing the questions and reviewing thoroughly all of your mistakes.
Yeah, review inbox for questions to get in there from drilling, this student had to have been adding them manually because it doesn't do that by default.
Oh, really? So, okay. So, wow. So this student has actually added an extra step to their studying. Yeah. Add it to my review inbox instead of just do the review right now.
Yeah.
And we need to be doing the review right now. I mean, I almost wonder if the drilling tool, if you click out of the review right away, it should be like, not so fast. What are
it
you
does
doing?
It does do that if you don't open the explanation and you got it wrong.
But this is somebody who's just like reflexively clicking right through that.
Yeah.
And going like, yeah, I don't really care. Let's get to that. But I'm going to add it to my review inbox and let me get to another question. That's not the way drilling is designed to be used. So this has nothing to do with fatigue. It just, you're not doing the drilling right. But thank you for writing in.
Yeah. This next question is from Aiden. The subject is higher diagnostic score, where to start? Hi, Nathan and Ben. I'm a rising junior, and I just started thinking about the LSAT this summer. My diagnostic was a 161. I got minus 4 on logical reasoning, minus 8 on reading comp, and minus 7 on games. Oh, and then minus 6 on LR.
Okay, so you're doing tests probably on LawHub or somewhere instead of doing tests on the Demon. The LSAT now has 3 scored sections. So you don't.
Yeah, and your best section is LR, and you just gave more weight to the logical reasoning section.
Yeah, that 161 is probably not really a 161 because LR is your best section and you're double weighting LR.
Yeah.
Underweighting reading comp and LG, which you're not as good at, or at least you weren't on this test.
I mean, regardless, even if you're in the 150s, that's a great diagnostic. It's a great starting point. But yeah
it really is. No, I mean, that's, we could translate that to a 157 or something, and then we would say, wow, that's a really good diagnostic. That's amazing. Yeah. Like you're doing great.
You are doing great. And so you can expect to hopefully to end in the high 160s, almost certainly the 170s. It would be hard to see you not getting there. But
yeah.
Your question is, I'm not sure where to go from here. Which section should I start on? Which, all three. You start on all three. You're not good at all of them. Well, you're good at them, but you could be better on all of them. Do I master logical reasoning first, since it's my best section, or attack RC or LG? I'm a big fan of the show, but I haven't heard much advice for students with higher diagnostic scores. Thank you, Aiden. Aiden, thanks for writing in. It sounds like Eric mentioned that you had mentioned Khan Academy earlier in your message. So maybe you're not with the Demon yet. I would try it out. Go to lsatdemon.com, get a free account. You can start drilling and doing time sections. One, you should do all three sections. So if you do three sections a week, you might even be able to do more than that. But if you start with three, you just do one section of each type from a test. So you'd start with test J and you do the three sections from that test, one a day or something like that. You can also do drilling. And by the way, drilling by default will jump around from logical reasoning to reading comp to games. So it will give you a mix based on how well you're doing.
Yeah, it's going to give you slightly more of your worst section, depending on how bad that section is compared to your other sections. It might weight it a little more heavily, but it will still give you a mix of the sections. And yeah, there's no such thing as master LR, then move on to the other sections. I mean, you're never going to be really, truly the master of LR. And the reason why I say that is because I don't think I'm the master of LR, or I don't think Ben is the master of LR. We haven't ever mastered it, right? We have to have this beginner's mindset where we're just going to do our best on every single question. We're going to sort it out, and we're not going to expect that we're going to get 100% of all of them right every single time. It's going to be more like, I'm going to do the work. I'm going to sort them out. I'm going to solve each question one at a time. I'm going to be able to figure them, most of them out. And you just don't, you don't need to be thinking about trying to master one section, especially not your best section. If you were going to master any section, it should probably be games, because games is the easiest section to score perfect on. It's also the section that people struggle with the most when they first start. So it is the section that is the easiest to improve. So if anything, I would probably spend more of my time on games, Aiden. But even then, I wouldn't be doing 100% games. I would be doing some sort of a mix.
The analogy isn't perfect, but think about a triathlon. right? You're not going to just like, oh, let me go master the running piece first.
The one I'm the best at, and I'll master that one for, I mean, there is no mastering running, right?
Yeah. And you wouldn't want to condition for that and then like not even touch the water.
You just sink to the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah. You're going to train all of them. And the same is true in the test. Even when you get to minus zero on the games, you never stop practicing them. You just don't practice them as much. Maybe 80% of your time is dedicated to reading comp and logical reasoning, but you're still going to do some games. So yeah, good luck. Go check out the demon. I think that will blow your mind.
Agreed. Connor writes in with the subject law school applications. Listing schools. Hi, Ben and Nathan. On law school applications, it asked, quote, please list all schools you have applied to / plan to apply to.
Why the hell did they write slash? Connor, I don't know if you did that or if you're literally quoting them, but I find that to be pretty informal on the school's part.
If you are literally quoting them, by the way, you need to put your periods on the inside of your closing quotation mark.
True.
Okay, so they're asking you what schools you have applied to or plan to apply to. Connor says, this comes off as a red flag when schools have this in their applications. I'm curious about the best way to tackle this request. I could see the admissions of a low-ranked school looking at someone with a 180, but noticed that they listed off high-ranked schools in the request mentioned above on the application. Then the school may deny this person to protect their yield percentage. I guess my questions are, one, do you think that it would reflect negatively upon me to leave this question blank? Number two, am I overthinking this question? It holds little to no weight on my application. Three, if you were applying broadly, how would you tackle this request from the schools? Thank you in advance. Best wishes, Connor. Is it an optional question?
Yeah, if it's optional, I would leave it blank. I'd be like, yeah, don't worry about it.
You're not required to respond to optional questions. And if you think that your answer is not going to help you in your application, you know, let's say you're applying to 30 schools and you're worried about yield protection, or what if you are applying to a whole bunch? I don't think applying to a bunch of higher ranked schools is going to hurt your application, though. I think that makes it look like you have a high estimation of your worth in the marketplace. If you put down that you had applied to 30 schools, I can see some schools being like, hey, the odds that this person's going to end up going here are very slim. If we care about our yield, we should probably not admit this person. Waitlist them, right?
Yep.
But if it's optional, you just don't have to answer. Probably as simple as that.
Yep. On to question two, are you overthinking this? Possibly.
It probably has little to no weight on your application, but they are asking you that question for a reason. And it probably has something to do with the negotiation that they want to do with you. You know, they want to have an idea. Is this student applying broadly or is this student applying narrowly? And I would just decline to answer the question.
Yep.
Like you walk onto a car lot. Oh, what other cars are you looking at?
Who have you talked to so far? Yeah, how's that going?
I like how you bit your lip when you did that.
Yeah.
What's your budget?
Yeah.
You don't have to answer questions like that. You just leave it blank if it's optional. If it's not optional, then I guess you have to answer it. Although, yeah, do they really have the right to require you to answer that question? Maybe they do.
Well, there's some gray area here, too, because there are schools that you plan to apply to. I can't imagine them holding you to account if you plan to apply to 10 and end up applying to 15. Right.
Right. Like, right.
So,
or you could have planned to apply to 30 and only apply to 2. I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
I think you just don't answer the question and then go, oh, I wasn't planning to apply anywhere else. Well, they have no way of ever. Okay. The one thing I wouldn't do is lie. I mean, there's just no point in lying, right? So don't try to game it. Don't like put five schools that you think are going to make you look somehow better on your application, or put five schools to get like red herrings to try to confuse them or whatever. Don't do any of that bullshit. Just don't answer it, or answer it honestly, I guess. But I feel like answering an optional question honestly here, it can't possibly help you, and it really can only probably hurt you.
Dishonestly.
No, answering dishonestly could definitely hurt you. But even answering honestly, I don't see how it helps you.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, I would just decline to answer. You don't need to take the witness stand. You don't do that. Okay. Anything else?
No. Thanks for writing in. Good luck, Connor. And I hope you are applying broadly. You said if you were applying broadly, and by that you mean you are. So that's great. This next question is coming from Abigail. Team member Abigail sent this in from the Ask button. It's about a stated question from an RC passage. The question says, stated question says, in the passage, the author cites which one of the following claims?
So it must be true.
Must be true. It was explicitly stated, right? The author cites which one of the following claims. Okay, here's the question. Stated questions always take me so long to answer, and I don't know what to do about it. I make a roadmap of the passage in my head.
What?
And try to refer back to the part of the passage that might have the answer, but they always seem to take me 2 minutes to get through. Any tips? Okay, we have a little extra information here. Abigail checked this student's reading comp history. And in the back end, we can see how much time they spent reading the passage and how much time they spent answering the questions for this particular passage.
Mm.
And Abigail says they spent 2 minutes reading the passage and 10 minutes answering the question.
Okay, well, there's your problem. You're not reading the passage well enough. It's called reading comprehension. You have to comprehend what you read. And I cannot comprehend a reading comprehension passage in 2 minutes. Ben cannot comprehend a reading passage in 2 minutes. So you're attempting to read the passage faster than either of us do. And then you're getting right into the question. And the question is like, I mean, because a stated question, that's the part that's really like bumping me here is, first of all, what the hell even is a stated question? I wrote a blog post and a lesson a couple years ago now that was basically like, they're all just must be true questions. I mean, on reading comp, that's all they're doing is they're asking you, what did it say? So they can say which one must be true or which one can be properly inferred or which one was stated. And to me, there's not really much of a difference. It's like, we're answering questions based on what the passage said. And you're trying to find answers that are, yeah, that's what they said. And I just don't differentiate. For me, there is no difference between a stated question or a must be true question or even a supported question. They're all the same thing. There's evidence in the passage that supports this answer. Okay.
I mean, I think this is going, I don't know if it's that deep. It's going one step further and it's telling you that this answer was explicitly stated as opposed to something that must be true.
I don't care. I don't even notice that shit. Like I never miss questions on reading comp. And I don't even notice the difference in these question types. I just don't think it's actually helpful. I mean, I get it. I think it's technically correct. I just don't think it's helpful. It's a distinction without a difference, or a difference without a distinction. Yeah, whatever. Point is, I don't need to know the difference between those question types. I know on reading comp, they're asking me, hey, what did it say? And whether it explicitly said it or whether it said something that necessarily implies it, or whether they said something that provides strong evidence in favor of, I just don't care. It's all the same to me. What did it say in the passage? And so, you know, this student has like this self-diagnosed problem with stated questions, but I, the LSAT teacher, don't even know that a stated question is a thing. So I guess I would give this student permission to just, like, let's let go of all that. How about we read the passage better in the first place? And then when they ask you a question, and we have this actual question, In the passage, the author cites which one of the following claims? Yeah, I mean, I read that and I go, it's a must be true. Which one did the author say? Well, I know what the author said because I read the passage better. And yeah, I mean, it's clear, right, that if this student is spending 2 minutes reading the passage, then yeah, it is going to take you 10 minutes to answer the questions, because as you answer the questions, you're probably going back and rereading the entire damn passage. Like, are you going and making your roadmap of the passage in response to trying to answer this question? Well, that's not what you were supposed to have already read the passage. You should have a good handle on what the passage said. And then on this type of a question, there would be no building of a roadmap. There would be, okay, well, four of these are going to be something that the author didn't say, or might even be the opposite of what the author said. One of these, I'm going to go, yeah, yeah, they said that. I remember them saying that. And then if I'm not 100% sure and I have to go back to the passage to find here's exactly where they said that, then I will. But I think more often than not, I'm not even going to have to go back to the passage to answer a question like this, because four of them are going to just be wrong. I mean, it's going to be, yeah, something they didn't say, or something that they actually said the opposite of, or a much stronger version of what they really said, which I could eliminate that.
I agree 100%. I think the two really key points here are, one, this person needs to spend way more time in the passage to understand the passage. Yeah. And two, what you're saying right there, you read this question. In the passage, the author cites which one of the following claims? I find it highly unlikely that I would go back. I would just be like, do I remember this being cited? No, I don't remember that being cited. Or like you said, it's going to be close, but it's going to say something that's too extreme or whatever. And you're like, no, because I understood what was cited. Not only do I, right? It's not just about finding that citation. It's like, I remember them talking about this. So yeah, I would, yeah, I don't want
16 sentences, by the way. This is test 46, passage one. And there's 16 sentences there. It's just not like it takes longer than 2 minutes to read, though. But
for sure. And understand.
But to take so I would read it in 5 minutes, maybe four or 5 minutes is probably how long it would take me to read those 16 sentences. I would not memorize those 16 sentences, but I would have a damn good idea what was in that passage. I mean, I would know what. Yeah, I mean, I would remember, like, if they say something that had just been said in those 16 sentences, I would remember that. And yeah, you're not remembering that, which just it just means that you're not reading the passage well enough in the first place. It's not about your roadmap. It's about actually reading and really understanding. You're skimming these passages. You're not really understanding them.
Yeah. I wanted to say the same thing. I find myself typically spending 4 or 5 minutes on the passage. And I hesitate to say that because I know some people are going to go out there and they're going to be like, okay, timer, five minutes or 4 minutes.
It might take you longer.
It might take you longer. But I do want to say that because I think people hear that number and they go, oh, shit, I'm nowhere close to that. Oh, I spent 2.5 minutes. Oh, I spent 3 minutes. And it's like, I don't know how much time they actually spend, but they hear 4 or 5 minutes like, wow, that's longer than what I expected for Ben and Nathan. And by the way, it might need to be even longer for you. But what it means in practice is that roughly 40 to 60% of the time is on the passage and the remaining 40 to 60% of the time is on the questions.
Yeah, this person is doing it the exact opposite way, where they spend 2 minutes on the passage. And then they get to answer A and they're like, I wonder if the passage said that because they didn't really read the passage. So then they're like going back to their roadmap and they're trying to confirm whether A was in the passage or not. Meanwhile, people who read the passage better in the first place read A and go, don't remember him saying that. Next.
Yep.
It's literally 5 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, and you're spending 20 seconds per answer choice to consult with your roadmap and see if it's on your roadmap or whatever weird thing you're doing. Instead, Ben and I are just like, nah, it wasn't about that. Nope, nah, they never said that. No, yep. They said the opposite of that. They did say something similar to this, but this is a way stronger version. So that's a trick. That's no, not that.
Yep.
Oh, this one. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I remember them. I think it seemed like it was like in the second paragraph, and then you go back to your thing and you go, oh yeah, there it is. Yeah. Oh, sure enough. That's exactly. Yeah. And that's
or
the answer.
Or sometimes I don't even go back, right? Because sometimes it's like, I don't remember if they said this exactly, but it sounds consistent with the conclusion. And these other four are shit.
Yeah.
So I'm done. Moving on.
Right. So you don't even need to go back and do that double check. But that's all because you did the work up front. I mean, this student is clearly not doing the work up front. They're backloading it in the questions themselves. And the problem with backloading the work into the questions themselves is that the wrong answers are in the questions, and the wrong answers are bullshit. The wrong answers, they distract you and confuse you and waste your time. You know, because think about the other thing that's happening to a student who approaches the test this way is that the questions themselves are going to infect their knowledge of the test passage.
Yeah.
Right. So what happens is they have to give wrong answers way too much credit. And then as you know, because they're like, well, I don't know, did it say that? But then as you read it and you think, did they say that? Then it's sort of like part of your brain is like, well, no, they said that now. I mean, it's part of the passage now.
Yeah.
Because you didn't read the passage well enough in the first place. So you've really got to separate, right? The passage is gold and the answer choices are shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're going in, you're like skimming through the gold part and getting right into the shit part. And now you got your shit and your gold all mixed up.
Not good. Impure gold.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, last thing, just a little number to throw out there. This student spent 16% of their time on the passage versus our typical 40 to maybe even 60% of our time on the passage.
Oh, yeah. I blaze through the questions. I mean, and it happens on all three sections. I take enough time to make a good diagram in logic games. Breeze through the questions. It's not uncommon at all to spend 5 minutes on a diagram and then 45 seconds to answer all five or six questions.
Yeah.
So it's really stark in games. Logical reasoning, spend all the time you need to spend to understand exactly what's going on in that argument. And sometimes the arguments are really convoluted, poorly written, missing pieces of evidence. You've got to take the time to think through, okay, wait, what are you even trying to say here? Okay, what's your evidence? What's your conclusion? Okay, rearrange it in your head. Okay, here we go. You never said whether the executive administrator is on the board.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you go to the question and the answer choices, you just fly right through it because you know that the answer needs to say, well, the executive administrator is a board position.
Yeah.
Reading comps,
by the way, with that question, the correct answer was worded differently, right? But it was fine because we understood the goal.
Yeah.
We understood what needed to be fixed versus someone who might have a strategy of like, oh, I recognize that this phrase was new in the conclusion. So I'm going to look for answers that talk about that. You know, it's like,
yeah,
this incomplete understanding, and it's like gimmicky. That stuff just doesn't work.
Yep. Okay. I think that's good. Next one here is from Fran, and it's about ChatGPT. You guys mentioned a question that may be added to law school applications about using ChatGPT. Is it in an applicant's best interest to always answer no to the usage of any AI assistance? Can it even be proven in the slightest that AI was used at some point in the application? There are sites and other AI that try to tell you if ChatGPT or AI assistance was used in a piece of text. However, they are extremely inaccurate at this point in time. The only way I can see anyone proving it is if they hook you up to a lie detector or something. Although I do not plan on using anything like that in my application, I do not see why anyone in their right mind would admit to using AI if it can't ever be proven that they used it. Thank you, Fran.
Wait, even if these other tools aren't accurate or extremely, I guess you're saying they're extremely inaccurate. I don't even know if that's true, but some of the ways the schools figure this out is they compare your LSAT writing sample to your application. You could have an essay that has a different kind of style to another part of your application where you've just maybe given some shorthand answers to questions. And they're like, wait a sec, you have a much different writing style here than you do there. I wouldn't be so confident that they can't at least be suspicious of outside involvement.
I just don't see what the point of it would be to, you know, I think I'm going to say, don't use ChatGPT on your law school applications. Like, for what? It seems like you're introducing a lot of risk for no reason.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that ChatGPT hallucinates. We know that it is going to, like, if you give it your resume, it's going to then make up shit about you to as part of your personal statement. Like, so Fran's not going to use it. I don't think anybody else should use it.
No. I don't think Fran is saying that she's not going to use it. I think she's saying she's not going to admit.
No, she said, I do not plan on using anything like that in my application.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Fran's not going to use it. She's just asking for her own. She's like, why would anyone ever admit to this?
Hmm.
And my question is, why would anyone ever do this?
Well, if anyone does it, what they're going to do is they're going to use it. And then if they're smart about it, they're going to then edit it. So they're using it as like a first
edit it.
Yeah. They're using it as a first draft, right? Which is not insignificant. First drafts are, you know, a lot of people sit on them.
What's it going to do? It's going to just like regurgitate all the details from your resume because you have to feed it something, right? Otherwise, it's just going to make up a bunch of, like, it could just write a random, it could write a random personal statement for law school for a complete unknown for like a cipher. It'll just make up, you know, that you have a history of whatever. It'll just start making up details that might fit with a law school application.
It's a weird question though, too, because let's say you actually wrote something without using ChatGPT, right? You just wrote something. I would strongly encourage people to put it through Grammarly.
Yeah.
That's AI assistance. So, and what attorney out there is not doing that?
Right. Isn't spell check AI?
Yeah, that'd be funny. You just say, yes, of course. It's called spell check.
Yeah, I would probably not be a snarky smart ass on my application. I mean, I think it goes back to our earlier question, which is just if it's an optional question, you can always just not answer it. If you did not use, and I think what they mean when they ask you if you've used, especially if they say, have you used ChatGPT or any other AI, you just say no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't be a smart ass about like, yeah, don't overthink it. Like they're not asking you about spell check.
Yeah.
You know,
that's been around forever.
Well, also that's default in every, like you can't do word processing without spell check automatically now.
Yeah.
Right. So you're going to get the red squiggly lines under shit that you misspelled and blue lines under things that you grammar errors or whatever. But I would just say, no, if it's an optional question, you don't even need to answer it at all. You should probably get in the habit of not answering optional questions unless they are going to help your application. Okay. Next.
Yeah.
Mark is asking about skipping questions in logical reasoning.
Many prep companies preach the idea of skipping questions, especially in logical reasoning. I know that the LSAT demon preaches a slow and smooth and, quote, solving the question, close quote, approach.
Imagine, like, that's so different from what everybody else does.
Take your wild time, right?
Actually solve the question.
Figure
who
it
would
out
have thought? Yeah, that is what we do. Yeah. And we do not recommend that you skip questions.
Mark continues, which also saves time in the process. That is true too. I'm a 157 to 160 scorer, and I find that I'm missing some very easy questions near the end of the section because I don't have time to assess them. Should I try to skip the harder questions, or should I just keep focusing on solving every problem no matter the difficulty? Appreciate your time, Mark. Look, Mark, you're playing the long game. So keep going, because you're going to eventually find that these harder questions are easier, and then you're going to occasionally get these little you know, what is it? Little gifts. You'll get to question 21 and it's an easy question for whatever reason they threw in at the end of the section, and you'll just continue to get it right, like all the other now easier questions that came before it.
My concern is that if you skip questions, like, okay, we could have a whole separate debate about whether you really can, in fact, skip the harder questions, because I just don't know that that's even possible. I mean, I can't really know how hard a question is until I do the entire thing. Until I've identified the correct answer, I can't tell you how hard that question is. Sometimes the argument could seem convoluted. Maybe it's really long.
But then it's like, what's the main point? You're like, well, the last sentence in this one turned out to be the main conclusion. So
Or it turns out to be a sufficient assumption question, and there's a real easy bridge between the evidence and the conclusion. It could turn out to be a weakened question where the correct answer is just kind of a real obvious objection to the logic. I don't know how hard it's going to be. And flip side, maybe the argument's really short. Maybe it seems very straightforward, but then the answer choices can be really convoluted. There can be two answers that are seem really similar to each other. I just don't know. I'm an LSAT expert, and I can't tell you how to skip the hard questions. So you probably shouldn't be trying to skip the hard questions. Like,
how do
you're already going to be well into that question before you know how difficult it really is. And bullshit techniques like reading the question first and skipping hard question types, I mean, that's really not where it's at. And we've talked about that for hours and hours and hours on previous episodes of the show.
Yeah.
So my worry is that this idea about skipping the harder questions, one, it might not even be possible. Two, if it is possible, I think it's one of these things where it's going to get you from 157 to 160 up to 162. But it's going to then prevent you from getting to 170.
Yeah, well, how often too? Because Mark, you're thinking about the times where you skip ahead and there were easier questions. There are also plenty of times where you skip ahead and there are just harder questions. Well, for the rest of that section.
Let me go a step further. Most of the time, if you skip questions, you are skipping to harder questions because the questions get harder nearer the end of the section. So, you know, if you miraculously can skip question number 12 because it's an unusually difficult question number 12, I don't even know how you can do that. But if you miraculously could, well, on average, numbers 13 and beyond are harder than what came before. So, like, all you're really doing is jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire. Yeah, there are some easy ones sprinkled all throughout the test, but you can't reliably identify those. And like Ben said, we're playing the long game, Mark. We're trying to get you to 170. I just don't give a shit about getting you to 162. I want you to build robust techniques that are going to lead to your best possible outcome, not some gimmicky bullshit that might get you 1 point today and cost you 10 points in the future. Noah writes in about serious facts on soft factors. Howdy, Ben and Nathan. I was wondering what kind of weight law schools place on the other parts of my application besides my UGPA, which is 3.86, and my LSAT, cold diagnostic 155, on May 30th, highest practice LSAT so far, 159. Okay, so LSAT in progress. Good cold diagnostic, by the way. Good UGPA. You're going to be a great applicant, Noah. And like those are the big factors. For example, my resume is filled with law experience, : I interned with my district attorney's office. I was captain of one of my university's mock trial teams. Shout out Texas A&M mock trial. A whoop. I don't know how to pronounce your onomatopoeia. I have a published research thesis on defamation law in different countries and how a jury can be tainted. And I'm working at a law firm as a law clerk right now over the summer. That's all great shit, Noah. How much will law schools consider things like that when looking at my application? Is that enough to put me over the top with people who have a similar or slightly higher LSAT or UGPA? Thanks, Noah.
I don't know how much it's going to do for people who have slightly higher LSATs, but it's definitely going to help you with people who have similar LSATs. You clearly understand that law is a certain kind of discipline. You're somewhat familiar with that. You're not an attorney yet, but you work at a law firm. You've published research on defamation law in different countries. So that, again, does not make you an expert, but you are familiar with what you're getting involved with. And I think that helps. They know that you're not confused.
But do not use that as permission to get anything less than your very best LSAT, Noah. I get the sense, and I hope it's not true, but we see this all the time where people write in and they're frustrated with their LSAT progress, but they have really good softs and they are looking for us to tell them, oh, well, but your softs are so good or your UGPA is so good.
Don't worry about it.
That you'll be able to overcome. And listen, the schools are going to tell you that. Fancy law school admissions consultants are going to tell you that because they just want your business. They want you. They want to start charging you $5,000 to work on your personal statement. The schools just want your apps. And so you're going to get a lot of people out there that are going to give you some bullshit advice here, but we're not going to give you the bullshit advice. The LSAT is the wrecking ball. That's the thing that's going to really just bash down the doors to whatever schools you want to go to. And, you know, Noah went to Texas A&M. Noah's probably interested, at least somewhat, in University of Texas Law School in Austin. I'm looking at Austin, Texas ABA 509 report. Their 50th percentile LSAT last year was 170. Their 75th percentile LSAT last year was 171. Noah, if you apply with less than a 170 to Texas, you know, relying on your softs, you might get in. But if you get your LSAT up to 170, which you definitely should be able to do because 155 is a really good cold diagnostic. You know, I don't know if Noah's a demon student, but if Noah was a demon student, turning a cold diagnostic of a 155 into a 170 is not that hard of a task. And if you do that, Noah, then, you know, that's a hard factor. All the other stuff on your resume just doesn't show up on Texas's 509 report. And because it doesn't show up on this public data that they have to report to the rankings agencies, to the American Bar Association, and to the world, the soft factors, they just don't have nearly the kind of impact that the hard factors of LSAT and GPA do. And you're such a great applicant, Noah, that I just hope you're not looking to take the shortcut here and go, well, you know, I've been working at the LSAT since May. It's May 30, by the way. So it was, you know, basically the beginning of June, and then highest practice LSAT 159 in early July. So it's like 1 month of prep and 4 points of improvement. And it looks like Noah might be looking for the like permission to tap out.
Yeah.
Of LSAT prep, which you're going to get bad advice on this, Noah, from lots of other places. The schools themselves, law school admissions consultants, pre-law advisors. You're just going to get all kinds of bullshit. But from, you know, we do this hundreds or thousands of times per year, right, with applicants. And we just know that the LSAT is the thing that really moves the needle. So your softs are great. And yes, your softs will differentiate you. See, this is what happens at the top schools, is that your softs differentiate you from people who have the same numbers as you do.
Mm-hmm.
Like right now, your softs, yeah, of course, your softs look great when you are compared with other people with a 159. But if they're comparing you with your 159 and someone else with a 167,
yeah,
your softs don't, they do not pull that kind of weight. That's my two cents. Now, there are exceptions, of course. There are people who get into great schools with bad LSATs, but that's the back door entry. And most people are going to go through the front door, which is kill the LSAT, kill your undergraduate GPA. Then you can start looking at the softs to differentiate you from all the other real, you know, real great candidates at these schools.
Yeah. Thanks for writing in, Noah. Your subject was serious facts on soft factors, but I think Nathan just gave you some serious facts on soft factors.
Well, I think maybe he was asking for some serious facts on soft
factors. Maybe he was asking. I didn't know if he was saying his facts were serious.
He was not dropping knowledge there. He was asking a question. So, yeah, I think that our position is pretty clear, right? You can and should improve that LSAT. You can do that. And it's like provides this obvious numerical differentiator between you and everyone else. And we know how intensely interested schools are in maintaining their LSAT medians. So you really should get that LSAT up, Noah. Don't use it. Don't use your great softs as an excuse for not putting in the hard work on the LSAT.
Yeah.
And I don't know where you're doing your prep, but 4 points in a month is not bad. If you haven't already checked out LSAT Demon, I think you should, because I think we could get you 14 points at least from your cold diagnostic, and maybe more than that. Justin writes in, I'll let you read it. Justin writes in with a response to our discussion of a Reason article about this new the Biden plan to forgive a whole bunch of college loans.
Yeah. And we had some concerns about that. We were thinking, hey, look, this is just going to encourage more people to borrow and more schools to charge more prices. But Justin writes, hi, Ben and Nathan, I believe the Reason article leaves out some critical information. While it's true that the government would still be using taxpayer money to pay off loans, a major objective of the plan is to cap debt accrual for borrowers.
That sounds like a great idea. If we really are going to cap debt accrual for borrowers, I'm interested.
Yeah. If I understand correctly, the previous IDR, this was income-driven repayment plan, repay, these stupid government names, accrues interest at a constant rate and then, under qualifying circumstances, adds the accrued interest to the principal.
Yes, that is how I understand income-based repayment, that you are sometimes paying less than the actual interest that is accruing on your loan. And if you do that, then it just gets capitalized into the principal value of your loan, which means your loan is going up while you continue to make payments, which is really shitty. Okay.
Yeah, it's a bad situation.
Yeah.
We can get into what caused that. But anyways, the new plan SAVE lowers the amount of, that's the name of the plan. The new plan SAVE lowers the amount of money borrowers need to pay each month from 10% of discretionary income to 5% for undergrad.
Okay, so just making the problem worse by letting people pay even less of their income. I mean, the problem with income-based repayment in the first place is that you're accruing interest, but you're not servicing your debt. If you don't pay your mortgage, the balance on your mortgage goes up. And that's essentially what's happening. You're paying, like, if you write a check and pay half your mortgage payment, well, they'll take your check, but they'll also just add the other half of it plus interest to your principal.
Yeah. So, and rewards, Justin continues, the new SAVE plan rewards borrowers for paying on time by simply paying off the remaining interest. So far, Justin, I'm not sure how your understanding of this new plan is any different from our understanding.
Well, right. So what's happening then is the government is stepping in and saying, hey, all you can actually afford is 5% of your income, and we'll cover the other 5%.
or the other whatever, because it whatever is the amount that would be what you'd have to pay. Because this is just 5% of your discretionary income. That's all you have to pay.
But that's the difference in the plans, right? Is that the government is going to say, hey, whatever you're not able to pay, we're going to essentially pay it for you.
Yeah. So that's that 5% plus whatever was on top of that.
What because difference does it make? There makes no difference whether you capitalize that and then forgive the debt at the end, or whether you just forgive
it.
I mean, I guess it's slightly better for the borrower if you're getting your, because you're essentially getting some of it forgiven over time, if I'm understanding correctly.
So it's psychologically, it's like already gone.
But
as
it's still
to-
fucking stupid if you're not capping the amount that people can borrow in the first place.
Yeah, so let me finish what Justin says here. The plan also allows loan forgiveness eligibility to start much sooner for those who have consistently paid on time, 10 years for balances under $12,000, an additional year for every 1,000. Ideally, smaller bills, less interest accrual, less time to accrue interest, net wins for borrowers, true, and maybe taxpayers too? How?
No.
How, no. Justin? The government's just saying we're going to pay more. We're going to take, we're going to require less from the borrowers, which means it's now less consequential to be a student loan borrower.
Justin's like, well, at least the government isn't accruing debt inside of these borrowers' accounts, right? That the government is making the payments timely rather than letting that whole thing build up and then forgiving it. It's more like they're sort of forgiving it over time. And so the government isn't also getting itself into debt.
But isn't the government the lender?
No, banks are the lender. The government is the guarantor, I think.
I thought Obama changed it so that those loans came in-house.
Well, okay, fine.
Maybe. I don't know.
It doesn't make any difference, because if the government is the lender, then all that's happening is the government is just forgiving debt earlier.
Yeah.
And I'm not a fan of debt forgiveness if they're not also stopping the fucking bleeding in the first place. This is
because it's just going to make it worse. This is what we were saying last time.
It's going to make it worse. It's a giveaway to schools. This is government largesse giving money to schools. And I do not have faith in the schools that they're good stewards of this money. Their law school tuitions have wildly outstripped inflation for the past like decades. And law school is now, I mean, all these graduate schools and undergrad for that matter are way more expensive than the market would actually bear, because the government is stepping in and subsidizing these loans.
Yep.
And I don't want the government to make college free. Well, that's a whole different issue, right? If we're going to have if that's actually what we're doing, is that we're going to make higher education free, then talk about that. Let's make that our focus of discussion. But that's not what they're doing. What they're doing instead is they're like, oh no, the schools are perfectly fine. The schools can keep charging these students as much money as they want. We'll continue loaning money to these students with no cap. Or we'll continue guaranteeing loans to these students with no cap, whichever way it's happened. I don't know, whatever, same difference. And that is causing the tuitions to go up. And I can't understand how anyone cannot understand. I'm not yelling at you, Justin. I'm yelling at Bernie Sanders and Biden and whoever else is like popping off with these, you know, fantastical loan forgiveness programs that don't have something to do with fixing the underlying problem in the first place.
Yeah. Notice what Justin says here. He says a major objective of the plan is to cap debt accrual for borrowers. We're talking about two different types of caps. This is capping once the debt has been accrued.
This is capping.
It's actually not
by
this
having
is not
the
capping.
Government
this is
pay
forgiveness.
It off.
This is forgiveness. It's
right.
Not capping.
No,
because the debt has already been accrued. The capping that we're talking about is preventing the loan from taking place in the first place. At least that is that big, because if the caps on the loans were tighter, if students couldn't take out as much money, then the schools would be forced to charge less. I mean, They know exactly how much money you can take out as soon as you talk to them. It doesn't matter what your financial situation is. They can always tell you, yeah, but just take out this amount in loans and you'll be fine. We'll cover the rest. That's what they say.
And we've seen how dependent schools are on these loans. I mean, they literally don't exist. If you stop letting people borrow money to go to school, the schools go away. Many of them go away. You know, and what would happen in the long run is if there is indeed a value to higher education, the schools would have to start charging a price that is commensurate with their value. The problem is that schools now charge prices that are way wildly over their value, just like the hospital charges way more for services than they're actually worth because they know that they're going to then bill your insurance. That's the same problem that's happening in higher education, where the schools are allowed to just step up and say, oh, yeah, well, we're not Harvard, but we're going to still charge Harvard prices.
Yeah.
And then dummies borrow all that money. I mean, I shouldn't say you're dumb. You're naive. You know, you're 21 and these programs exist. And you're like, well, the government surely wouldn't be leading me astray. They are leading you astray. They're setting you up for a real tragedy where you're going to end up owing a shit ton of money down the line. And these programs are like, I'm trying to pick a metaphor here. You know, it's like trying to put the horses back in the barn instead of just locking up the barn in the first place and not letting them get out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Justin, maybe I'm not understanding what you're saying, but I don't see anything here that makes me change my mind at all about that Reason article. I would love to hear what, you know, follow up from you, Justin, or follow up from anybody else who's interested in this issue, but I don't see how I'm never going to enthusiastically support a plan that is about debt repayment or debt forgiveness or these complicated income-based repayment plans where the government's going to be stepping in and subsidizing. I'm never going to be a supporter of any of this if it doesn't also come with just a hard cap on, look, you can't borrow more. We are not going to be endorsing these loans or facilitating these loans or giving these loans ourselves with no limit on how much the schools can charge. Because when you do that, it creates this like third party problem, which we think is what's responsible for this wild inflation in tuitions. Am I missing anything?
No, I would just add one anecdote to this. One of our friends, he has a couple kids, and I guess he took out grad plus loans or something. He's several years older than us, but still working to pay off those grad plus loans for his kids. It just makes me sick. I'm like, oh man, how did you get wrapped into that situation?
Uh-huh. It's doubly gross when it comes to law schools. Because law schools play this scholarship game where they try to attract the most promising students by giving them significant tuition discounts, frequently up to 100%, sometimes even exceeding 100% of tuition. And so, you know, think about this now. You've got a government program that allows people to borrow money to go to this school with no cap.
Yep.
At the same time, that school is charging some of the people nothing at all. In fact, it might be giving some of the people money to go to the school.
Yeah.
While other people are borrowing $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year to just turn straight over to the school, the school would never make that loan if it wasn't government guaranteed. If it wasn't the government making the loan or the government guaranteeing the loan, then that loan would never be made because the marketplace is going to go, huh? $80,000 for that school? That's not a good investment. We can't loan you that money. Have you ever seen how bankers are about mortgages and shit like that?
Yeah, seriously. I mean, skittish.
No, well, because they should be. You know, if you're lending money, your job is to lend money to people who don't need it, essentially. Because otherwise, if they really need it, then the odds get pretty bad that they're going to be able to pay you back. And especially in this context where you're essentially trading you know, over 3 years, you might trade $250,000 for a piece of paper.
Yep.
And the odds that that piece of paper is going to actually be worth not just $250,000, but, you know, way more than that, so that you can actually recoup that $250,000 while you're swimming against interest rates that are making it go, you know, higher and higher and higher. So you have to pay back a lot more than what you actually borrowed in the first place, as everyone knows. And those loans would not exist if it weren't for these government programs. So, and trust me, I'm like kind of a liberal.
Yeah.
But I'm not a Democrat, and I'm not fucking stupid where I am going to be, you know, you can't just pander to me and say like, oh, but this is going to be great because it's going to be good for these kids who are borrowing. Trust me, I want what's good for these kids who are borrowing. But if you're not fixing the system, then you're not going to like trick me into thinking that you're doing something.
It's just a short-term solution. It's like some people are drowning, throw them a lifeline. Now make it more likely that more people are going to jump in the water.
Exactly. It's a short-term solution that actually makes the long-term problem worse.
Yeah. Thanks, Justin. Let us know if we misunderstood anything you were trying to say.
Oh, we could be totally wrong about this. And I want to know if we are. So please go to thinkinglsat.com and give us some feedback about our commentary on that or our commentary on anything else. We sometimes state our opinions strongly, but we are open to new data and thinking about these things in a different way. I want to be right. Or I want to learn, you know, to be right. I don't care whether I was right today. I want to be right tomorrow. So please tell me if I'm getting it wrong. But yeah, the way I understand this stuff, it just seems like it seems patronizing. It seems insulting, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, how stupid do you think we are that some overly convoluted, like, you know, throw 10 different acronyms at me?
Yeah.
Again, I'm not yelling at you, Justin. I'm yelling at the people who are perpetrating these plans. But I am not getting excited about these plans. These plans seem like they are, hey, how do I get a bunch of 20 somethings to vote for me in the next election?
Mm.
And I am intensely interested in what's good for those 20 somethings. But these plans don't seem good for you know, it's like, oh, if you get some of your debt forgiven, then that might be good for you personally. But if all you're doing is making it worse for your younger siblings or for your own kids, then how is that that's just not a solution to the problem.
Agreed.
Okay, cool.
Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us at thinkinglsat.com. If you have questions about the LSAT Demon, email help@lsatdemon.com. You can also check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 412 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.